Hello, and welcome to the Above Average Irrelevance podcast. I'm Matt Weaver. I'm here with Scott Nelson. This is episode 14, and today, unusually, is Friday, May 13th. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning. It's all my fault. I was occupied earlier this week.
It turns out it's okay to have your own life, I guess. Just this once. But here we are. It's a rainy Friday, and my cup of coffee is almost full.
My cup of coffee as well.
Yeah. So our docket is not very thick this week. But that's okay. There's interesting things to talk about, no matter what. So first, let's start with the one that maybe we don't actually have a lot to say about. But I found this 747 pilot's essay about what it's like to fly a 747. And it has some pretty pictures. And the author talks about how, not really how different, but the unique perspective you get when you spend your time flying between far-flung destinations, right? Like he commented that, you know, the world seems overcrowded, but yet, you know, he spends a lot of time flying over pieces of land that are empty, that have almost no one living in them. But the cities are crowded, that's for sure. So, I don't know. What'd you think?
Yeah, it was very interesting.
I mostly just like the pictures.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I'm looking at them again. I'm glad he didn't take any selfies. Like, the idea of a pilot taking pictures out of the cockpit is interesting.
Well, I mean, you know, when the plane is in flight and clear skies and it's on autopilot.
Right? He's just sitting there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, his job is just to make sure the computer isn't screwing it up. So, I mean, there are people in, you can find pictures from people in fighter planes and everything else, right? I mean, as it turns out, lots of flying involves sitting there and trying to pay attention. Kind of like driving.
I've always found the concept of being a pilot, that profession, to be kind of crazy.
Why?
Just because, I mean, I think it takes a certain kind of person to want to spend that much time kind of isolated, you know, in a plane, in the sky. I don't know. I mean, just the experience of flying for me, like it's an event thing, you know, it's not something I do all the time. It's kind of a big deal. It's, you know, I get a little nervous, a little claustrophobic. I mean, I'm sure if you're a pilot, you get used to it, but the idea that you're spending a majority of your professional life, you know, crammed in this little space in a fairly high pressure situation, floating miles above the earth.
Well,
it's pretty crazy.
Maybe, you know, none of the pilots are sitting in the middle seat back in row 37, so their comfort level on the airplane.
I bet they still don't have that much leg room.
I would disagree, because I think the design of cockpits pay very close attention to the comfort of the people operating them as a way to reduce pilot distraction, right? I mean, if you're distracted because your legs are achy because you're sitting in an uncomfortable way, that's going to reduce your capability to fly the plane effectively. And so I would think, you know, they're not going to play table tennis, you know, ping pong up in the cockpit, but I think it's probably a more comfortable place to sit than almost anywhere else on the plane.
What I get from this piece, too, is that obviously this guy has had a lot of time to think and reflect, you know, about his profession, about his place in the world, you know, which is cool.
Well, if he's flying a 747, I mean, that doesn't take you from, you know, Cleveland to Boise, right? That takes you from Chicago to London. Hmm. I mean, so that's, these are long haul flights. The thing that I find most intriguing about it is you would regularly have time to go hang out in different cities. Like the notion that you're going to wake up one morning in Seattle and then land in Korea and then spend a day in Korea and come back again would be a common thing. And so you wouldn't necessarily, you know, have one continuous month to spend in a city, but you'd fly a regular route and you'd gain the opportunity to kind of piecemeal explore a city along your route with certain regularity. I don't know, maybe I'm being overly romantic, but...
No, I think so. I think it has to be a very different experience if you're single, you know, or have relatively few attachments here than if you're not.
Yeah, I suppose that's true.
You know. But it was cool. I see he has a book about flying and about his path to becoming a pilot.
Yeah. I wonder if he wrote it while he was flying. Pecking away on the iPad.
Yeah. Could be.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk about these next two articles, which relate to the article we talked about last week, where the study about the Biggest Loser people came out and said these people lost a lot of weight and their metabolism was depressed and stayed that way, which is a contributing factor to why they gained back so much of the weight that they had lost. And so you found two articles. One was the guy who lost 100 pounds in a year. And you said it was just, he got on the treadmill and spent an hour walking every day. Like every day. His birthday, you know, Christmas Day, right? Every day. An hour on the treadmill.
Yeah, and I mean, I think he was presenting it like this was my, you know, my... I think he called it a dumb way that I lost weight, which I don't think it's particularly dumb, but I don't know if that's a play on the, you know, one easy tip for losing your belly fat or whatever. But I guess what he meant is it's not particularly sophisticated. He went to the gym every day and walked for 60 minutes on the treadmill. And he said, like, at an incline, you know, a fast pace. And it was just the consistency of doing that mm-hmm. that then drove the other changes in his life. That ultimately resulted in the weight loss. And I mean, I really identify with that. That's the biggest struggle, I think, is consistency and accountability and the way those two play with each other.
Well, so you could say that he made spending an hour on the treadmill a day part of his life, right? So he made a fundamental change. And now his regular life involves spending an hour on the treadmill. Does he still do it now that he's lost a bunch of weight?
He didn't say, but I bet he does. That's an interesting... That would be interesting to know, too, because these people who did the Biggest Loser deal and now their metabolisms are slow, and the one person they studied who maintained success said she continues to work out for an hour or 2 hours or whatever she can every day. I mean, it's this constant deal. You know... Maybe he ended up with the same kind of thing where his metabolism slowed down, but as long as he continues doing the hour a day, he'll maintain the weight. I don't know.
It's, I guess I'm really curious if the rate of weight loss matters for your metabolism. Like, that's the thing I want to know.
I think that's what the subsequent studies will be based upon this Biggest Loser study.
Yeah.
Like, I've seen this all over the web this week and a bunch of reactions to it, and I feel like this was kind of a...
Yeah, I heard this. They were talking about that Biggest Loser study on mm-hmm. public radio, right? Mm-hmm. Which It's officially, now it's big time. It's on public radio. Mm-hmm. Right?
So I think there will be subsequent studies of, you know, because that study, we talked about this last week, didn't really come out with the why. It just identified the what was happening with these people's bodies.
Well, because the result was not what was expected.
Right.
That's okay. That's how science works.
Yeah. So this consistency thing, I mean, that's something that I struggle with. I've been doing this program where I am going and working out at 6 a.m. It runs 6 days a week. I don't make it all 6 days a week. And I have that moment when my alarm goes off and it's 5:30 and I lay there for a minute and I think, you know, am I going to do it? And frequently what happens is I hit snooze and then I decide I'm not, I just can't, I don't want to. And then like at the very last second, I
go and like, do it.
Regain my resolve and I get out of bed and then I race around because now I'm running late and I have to get ready and get in the car and get there. And it's like a struggle every day.
Do you think it's because it's at 6 a.m. that you're trying to be somewhere at 6 a.m.?
Morning makes it worse, but I've had the opportunity to do the same thing at, you know, 5 p.m.
still
every day. And it's just, there's always something else to do, something better, some excuse, some reason not to, you know.
I have found my time at the gym has created for itself its own need for me to go to the gym. So what does that mean? That means if I miss a day or things get busy in my life and I don't go to the gym, I'm traveling, whatever, after a day or two of missing, I kind of feel it. Like I kind of have this, man, you really need to go to the gym. Right. And, you know, because it's the spending some time on the treadmill, running or whatever, right, that doing the workout helps my mental state. It helps everybody's mental state, right? And I kind of notice that. And I kind of, you know, my energy level's a little bit lower, right, when I miss, you know, a couple of days. And usually I end up, I'm not sore anywhere, which strangely is its own warning sign. Like, man, there is no part of you that's a little bit sore. You know, there's no way that you move that reminds you that you did, you know, one extra set of squats or did one extra rep on the lat pull down machine or whatever it is that you're doing. That, you know, whatever muscle group is sore. And when all that goes away, I kind of have this, not really a panicked reaction, but it's one of those like, oh, you you really need to go to the gym. And so that's been a reinforcement for me, which is helpful. I think that means it's now a habit, right? When I'm noticing that I'm not doing it. So that's a virtuous cycle habit, which is good for me. But I feel like if it pushed past that, you know, like if you didn't go for a few more days anyway, then you would kind of go over the crest of the hill and then be on the, oh man, I'm too tired today. I'm not going to go to the gym. Right. Which would be bad. Then you'd kind of lose the habit, I think. At least that's what I feel like. So, I hope, I guess is the right way that to say it. I hope if the amount of effort and energy and things that I do in the gym are something that I can do at a sustainable pace, which I think that they are, and that allow me to, you know, lose weight now and eventually allow me to settle into some more healthy, stable weight in the future, that that'll be okay. And I won't necessarily be struggling against, you know, some metabolism that's fighting against me, you know, in an extreme way. Because I don't feel like, I mean, I probably eat better now than I did a year ago, but I don't regularly feel like I'm
dieting.
Yeah, it's just about different food choices, right? I mean, if I eat out in a restaurant, my default answer is just to get a salad, and that's perfectly fine.
Every bite of that salad, or do you like that salad?
No, some of them I like.
Are you sacrificing by eating that salad?
No, some of them I like better than others, right? Some restaurants have better salads than others. But the thing about it is every so often, you know, you're out and you're someplace and it's, the purpose is not to eat a salad. It's to eat whatever else, right? And, you know, the portions are so big, you eat it and you kind of walk away and you're like, man, I'm over full, or maybe that was a little greasy, or, you know, I've passed the point of enjoyment for that. Like, I probably would have been happier eating a salad and one quarter portion of what I ate, just enough to get, you know, to enjoy the flavors and the textures of whatever it is that you're eating, right? You know, I definitely don't need a 16-ounce steak and a quart of mashed potatoes, right? But that's what you'll be served, right? What I really need is, you know, an excellent 4-ounce piece of that steak, right? And, you know, 6 spoonfuls of the mashed potatoes and a good sized salad. Mm. And then I would both have enjoyed the eating of a steak and still feel clean, not weighed down by overeating or all of the fatty whatever that I ate. That I'd fundamentally be happier. Do you find this as a thing for you?
Yeah. It's tough eating out to deal with portions, actually. Unless you're going to some place that's part of the, like, cachet of the restaurant is small gourmet portions.
Right.
You're just guaranteed to get too much of everything at restaurants. Well, so the eating the salad, I think, is a way to just forgo that whole portion dilemma.
I don't know that I've ever eaten all of a salad. Every so often I get a salad that's a normal person size, but almost always
even the salad is too much.
Yeah, the salad is too big, but, you know, you eat what you're going to eat, and then you look at it and you're like, oh, that's a bunch of lettuce, and, you know, those cucumbers are kind of dodgy, right? You know, you don't feel bad. I have no compelling need at all to finish salad. But if I'm eating a burger,
right,
not
leaving that behind.
No, right? And all the fries that go with it. I mean, that's a really hard thing to do. In fact, I was...
No fry left behind.
I was someplace last night that serves burgers and fries, and that's really just about all that they have there. You know, it's downtown, it's upstairs, you probably know where it is.
Oh, I know this place of which you speak.
And it's really good, right? I mean, it's a genuinely outstanding burger, and I ate the whole damn thing and all the fries that came with it. And, you know, it's the first time I've done that in 2 weeks, right? So it's not the end of the world for me, but, you know, if that's just what you're eating, right, you're in trouble. No, that's not sustainable, right?
I have regularly gone to that place and gotten a burger, no bun, side salad instead of fries, and it's not the same experience.
No, I often get a salad as opposed to the fries, because I have some friends that really like to eat there, and that's the halfway point, right? I have the burger, and I skip the fries. Because their fries are good there, but they're not the best fries in town.
They're Potatoes fried in oil.
That's right. So, you know, that's how I escape from that place without feeling like I'm in trouble. But still eating the entire, just the whole burger and, you know, part of the side salad, like you walk out of it and you're like, well, man, I can't eat here again for a week, right? I mean, it's, I don't know. I really only need like 2/3 of that burger. And but you get the whole burger. What are you going to do? Like cut a third of it out and give it to the waiter and say, take this away from me? I don't know. It's hard to do. So,
yeah. So a lot of the feedback that I saw and just talking to people and comments I read and stuff after that Biggest Loser article came out was basically just discouragement. Like, well, if this is how it's going to be, you know, because the bent of that article was kind of that your body is like desperately trying to return to whatever weight it was at, kind of thing. So the reaction to that was, well, then I'm screwed. There's no hope, you know?
So that's how it's been explained, right? Your body's trying to return to this other weight. And I understand that explanation. And I suspect that that's probably a way that the scientists can explain it for lay people. But that explanation is a big steaming pile, right? Like
just that your body has adapted to a particular way of eating and exercising, and it wants to maintain that status.
You've still personified the cells in my body as having some desire, right? They want to maintain. What the hell does that even mean, right? Something has happened, right? I have forced a change on my body because I've changed my exertion level, and I've changed my input. And that's caused some chemical reaction inside my body. Maybe it's caused a genetic mutation. I don't know, right? But there's been something that's caused a change, and the output of the change is that we can measure is a reduction in metabolism, right? I don't think, you know, the fat cells that are wrapped around my tricep are saying, oh no, there's less of us. We got to have more of them. They're plotting against you, right? That is not the right way to discuss this, because it implies that there's some sort of like sentience living in my fat that's working against me, which is kind of how it works,
except you're talking in terms of like, you know, signals being sent to your brain, but that's how your body works. You don't think those cells are sending a signal to your brain? Feed me?
Well,
potentially. I'm not a biologist. I took biology in high school.
Yeah, that's right. Me too. I feel like there's...
But I know my fat cells are saying, feed me!
Feed me, Seymour. I feel like there has been a chemical reaction that's gone on. And I'd be very interested to hear a more realistic explanation than my body wants to return to its previous weight. Because that explanation just, it doesn't pass the BS test for me, right? It just, like, for soundbite science, I get it. I can't even fault the researchers and the journalists from reporting it. But that explanation leaves me wanting more, because that's, quite frankly, a really bad explanation. So if I had one major criticism in all the reporting that's gone on this topic, that's it, right? Stop lying to me with something that is, you know, absolutely false, right? My fat cells don't have wants and needs and desires, right? I have wants and needs and desires, right? And my body...
Your biology may be working against you.
I'm willing to accept that my biology may be working against me. And let's talk about what in the biology is causing that to happen. And the answer is, I think, well, we don't know. Because this is an unusual thing, right? Mm-hmm. But I would be happier if the discussion was less personified and more real, more scientific.
So this one article I had posted then, the title is, I'm an obesity doctor, I've seen long-term weight loss work, and here's how. And then the subtitle is, "Don't let the Biggest Loser study get you down. There's hope." So it's like the comeback to that idea that things are hopeless now. Yeah. And the interesting thing in this article, it kind of had a couple of things. Number one was setting like a big goal. You know, I'm going to lose 100 pounds. And I know this to be true. That's a way to set yourself up for failure.
Yeah.
Because you want to achieve something very quickly. I want to lose the weight today. And if I don't, you know, then why even try? Let's have a burger and fries.
Yeah.
Kind of attitude. And that's something that I struggle with. You know, it's hard to set short-term goals, or not necessarily goals at all. Maybe just, I want to move in this direction.
So I mean,
there's numbers involved in weight loss, and anytime there's numbers involved, there's concrete values.
Well, that's how Fitbit works, know,
right?
It puts a number
how
on
many steps.
Thing. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. Weight loss fitness is all about numbers on things.
Yeah. So, it is my nature to embrace the numbers. Some people would say I obsessively weigh myself, but the reality is every morning I get up and, you know, before I step in the shower, I step on the scale. It's almost the same time every day. You know, it's a consistent time, and I know that it is natural for my body weight to fluctuate around, right? And I've been doing this, you know, almost every day for a very long time. So I know that if I, you know, yesterday I had this burger, and today or maybe tomorrow I might weigh a pound or two more as a consequence of that, right? I know that if I have if I make a bowl of popcorn and watch a movie and it's, you know, salty and tasty and really good, right? That salt is going to make a change in how much water is inside my body. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to see that on a scale. And that stuff doesn't bother me, right? It really doesn't bother me. But knowing that number, right? Like, I know what my number was this morning. It happens to be the same number as yesterday, right? And I have some theories why. It's almost like, you know, the stock market was up today. Why was that? Oh, right. You know, da, da, da. I mean, I have this running kind of commentary in my head about why the number is what it is today based on the last couple of days of my own personal history. And that I find is valuable, because sometimes you look at that number and maybe it's creeped up and you think about what you've done in the last couple of days and you're like, oh, yeah, we're having...
Course correct.
We're having a salad today, mm-hmm. right? You know, and that's just going to be what it is. And I'm not going to go out and have five beers with the guys. I'm going to go out and have one beer or two beers. Right. And that's valuable for me,
mm-hmm.
because I've put a number and I can correlate it with actions, which allows me to make improvements. But that's a learned skill, right? Like in my Fitbit app, it asks you to set a weight loss goal. Right. And, I'm effectively, like, from where I set that goal, what I weighed when I set that goal and what that goal is now, it was effectively 10 pounds, right? Like, I want to get the next 10 pounds down. And that's, you know, I really want to get another 70 or 80 pounds down, right? But I'm not worried about that. I'm worried about getting to that next 10 pounds down, right? And once I get there, I'll update the thing again.
See, and most people, I would say a vast majority of people don't do that. They put in their ultimate goal weight, and then Fitbit tells them, you need to lose 90 pounds. It will take you,
yeah,
you know, 180 weeks or whatever.
Right. And that's not helpful.
That's discouraging.
Yeah. But, on my journey, right, I've lost basically 20 pounds so far. That's not yet 10% from what I weighed when I started, but, it's enough, right? Like it's a noticeable change, right?
Mm-hmm.
My jeans fit differently. There are some clothes that, you know, I used to look like a you know, gorilla stuffed in a suit, in a monkey suit or something, you know, wearing, right? You just, you put on this thing and you're like, oh, I'm too fat for this now, right? And and that stuff fits better. Some of it I still don't wear, but, you know, 20 pounds is enough. You know, that's a real noticeable change, right? And so that's motivation for me to keep going, right?
The other key takeaway from this article was dieting is not a means to an end. Like, if you're not enjoying yourself, if you're not enjoying the lifestyle while you're trying to lose weight, then you will never maintain it, even if you do lose the weight.
No, because you'll go back to your old way, and then your body will settle at the weight that you would be from that old way.
Right. And I mean, that's a correlation to the Biggest Loser method. I mean, obviously you're not enjoying your life while you're working out 8 hours a day, monitoring every little calorie you eat. And yeah. I mean, that's an extreme example of the situation, but still it's the situation. If you're not leading a lifestyle that you want to maintain while you're losing weight, you know, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah. And when you think about it, you know, that guy was doing an hour on the treadmill walking, right? That's probably about 3 miles, right? 20 minute miles. That's a good walking pace, maybe a little more, maybe a little less, depending on your individual preferences. I'm personally a slow walker, but, and so that's about 3 miles. That's about 6,000 steps on Fitbit, right? And Fitbit is pushing you to do 10,000 steps a day. And I know that, you know, I, as a programmer, right, I have a pretty sedentary lifestyle, sitting in front of the computer all the time. So, you know, it can be easy for me to only do 2,000 steps in a day, just getting up and walking around the house and sitting in front of the computer and walking, you know, down to the cafeteria or whatever it is that you do for lunch, right? But if you're doing 10,000 steps a day at roughly 2,000 steps a mile, I mean, that means you're moving 5 miles a day, which for a lot of people would be like your normal life plus an hour on the treadmill. The fact that this guy was doing it on a treadmill just gives him, he's created a space and time to do that work that he was consistent about. Mm-hmm. I don't know, seems to be a lot of correlation there between Fitbit saying, hey, move 10,000 steps a day. Mm-hmm. And even as much as I work out and try to move, you know, my 7-day rolling average in Fitbit is not 70,000 steps. Right. My girlfriend is currently beating me. Mm. That's
get on that.
Yeah.
So he talked about it too. I mean, he genuinely enjoyed the hour on the treadmill. He took he said he took a tablet and watched TV sometimes. Yeah. I mean,
I listen to podcasts. I love it.
It's kind of exactly what this other guy is saying. If you're not doing something that you enjoy doing, you aren't going to continue it.
Yeah.
So maybe that says something about my getting up at 6 a.m. and hating it every day. I don't know.
Well,
makes me think about it at least.
Is there a way that you could enjoy it?
I don't know.
Like, what is it that you don't like about it?
I love the workout. I don't like getting up.
Okay.
I've tried at several points over my life, like, really focused effort to become what I would call a morning person, which is kind of a ridiculous term. But the idea, to me, a morning person gets up like before 6 a.m. every day, whether they need to or not.
Yeah. And I just call that old.
Yeah. I guess that's something I have to look forward to in old age, right? Older people are always talking about how they can't sleep and they get up at 4 a.m. and
they just don't need the same.
They just, exactly.
Yeah. So
I require sleep.
How much do you require?
About 7 hours.
So if you're trying to get up at 5:30, Are you going to bed at 10:30?
No, who the hell goes to bed at 10:30? That's the problem.
So maybe that's the problem, right? You need to set an alarm at 10 o'clock that says...
Go to bed now.
Brush your teeth and go to bed, Scott. That's what you need. You don't need an alarm.
Which means I need to stop staring at glowing screens at like 9:30.
No, no, no. Night shift is going to save us all.
Oh, night shift.
Yeah, no.
So anyway, I probably need to make another concerted effort to exactly start going to bed. But circumstances make it very difficult, even when I've tried to do that. I mean, sometimes we hang out late. Yeah. And then, I mean, am I going to get up at 10 o'clock and walk out and say, sorry, I got to go to bed? Or you're at the bar or, you know, I'm doing this musical. Our shows run until 10:15. Am I supposed to race home and like immediately fall asleep? I mean, it's impossible. Like life sometimes makes it impossible to go to bed at 10 o'clock.
Certainly. So the society doesn't view 10 o'clock as too late, right? Like it, you know, 11 o'clock is starting to get late in society. But I have a friend works at the post office. You know, his office that he works at is open half days. It's open in the mornings. So he's got to get there, you know, at O dark 30 to get the mail sorted and whatever and be ready for the office to open. And then it's open for its half day and then he's done, right? But it means now, when I go hang out with him, I'm going to hang out with him this weekend, right? And I'll, you know, all the friends are going to get together. And we're really planning on at 9 o'clock when he passes out and goes to sleep, what are the rest of us going to do, mm-hmm. right? Because we know that that's just what's going to happen because he's getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning, right? And that's just how it works for him. And that's okay. Right.
I know, but for me, it's not okay. If I think back, like probably a majority of like the most fun moments or conversations or things that have happened in my life have probably happened after 11 p.m. Like,
but what percentage of the nights that you're up past 11 are those super fun times? Does that always happen on a random Tuesday, or should you stop watching Netflix and gone to bed?
I don't know. You're right. But it's, once again, it's like, well, once I'm off the habit of going to bed early, so
yeah,
Friday night, Saturday night, then it's like, well, then Sunday night, it's really hard to go to bed because there's really good TV on. And then, I don't know. It's hard.
I do have a friend that there are some times in his life where he gets on this night schedule where he's up late, does most of his work in the night, and then goes to bed, you know, really late at night and sleeps most of the morning. And when I go visit him and hang out for a weekend, he's, you know, hey, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. Let's open another bottle of scotch, right? I mean, that's, you know, and so you're up and you're doing whatever. And then, you know, it only takes a couple of days and then your sleep schedule is totally messed up, right? And I tell him when he's on these things, I'm like, when I come to visit you, it isn't that I've come to commit, you know, my weekend to hanging out with you. I've committed my weekend and all next week.
Getting back on track.
Because you have totally messed up my schedule, right? And I'm going to be tired. And it's a lot of work to shift that back. I don't know. It's tough. I think you would improve, though. It would be easier for you to get up in the mornings if at least two nights a week you got to bed at 10 o'clock and got a full night's rest. Because if you're anything like me, you know, one night of not ideal sleep or enough sleep, you know, you're dragging a little bit the next day, but it's not the end of the world. It's on the third day
mm-hmm.
where it's really... That's a real problem. And so I would guess, even if it's just two or three nights a week, you could commit to getting the right amount of sleep that you need. You'd probably improve your chances of making it to your 6 a.m. class dramatically. That's kind of a Kaizen thing, right?
Baby steps.
Just one day a week. commit to getting to bed at 10 o'clock. And see how it goes.
Okay. I'm going to do it.
All right. It's public now.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you about it next week.
Well, maybe not next week. Maybe I'm going to do it the following week.
Well, you're going to have no excuse next week because you're not even going to be right. at home. So, yeah. What else should we talk about?
I don't have much. You know, I haven't spent a lot of time at a computer this week. I've been working outside and working on getting my garden planted.
Yeah. So there's a... let's talk about Apple for a second. So you have an iPhone 6 Plus.
Correct.
And you have expressed, you know, now it's 18 months old and you're jonesing for a new phone. What if there are some rumors that would suggest that the next phone will be this same form factor? Is that okay?
I'll be less excited to get it, that's for sure.
So does the form factor matter?
It does from the perspective of wanting something new. I don't really have any complaints about this form factor. A lot of people complain about...
camera bump!
Yeah, that... I have never cared about the camera bump. It's sufficiently thin for my liking. I feel like I like the weight of it. Probably my only complaint is the power button being directly across from the volume button that I regularly am hitting multiple buttons at a time.
I kind of wish it was higher.
So from a form factor perspective, I think they should fix that.
Yeah.
Like, I liked the older style, even though I never had one, from Androids I've had and stuff, where the power button is on the top.
Even on the giant phone?
Even on the giant phone, because I can hold it in my palm and hit that.
Because you have giant gorilla hands.
Yeah. I could even do it with my index finger. So I'd prefer that. I understand why they didn't do that. But so that's my biggest complaint, is the proximity in, you know, horizontally of the power button and the volume button.
So the it has been my experience that I have liked all of the S phones that I've had better than the non-S phones.
But the hardware is always the same, right?
No, the hardware is always, you know, one tick.
I mean, the form factor is always the same.
Yeah.
Like the S phone, your S phone is the same as my non-S phone.
Right. But I feel like...
it just works better.
Well, I feel like they've had an opportunity to tweak it in subtle ways. I don't know. It's been my experience that the S phones are better.
It's interesting to me that the discussion we've had about them removing the headphone jack, about adding better speakers, I'm a little wary that that will come to fruition if they're not changing the form factor. Or if it does and they don't change the form factor, then they're probably not using the full potential of whatever they've achieved with that change. Because those are the kind of things that to me would require a redesign of how components are laid out to take full advantage of whatever this...
yeah.
You know, form factor changes.
One of the things I've noticed, and this is, you know, being an old man, I've noticed that kids today spend a lot of time blasting out their music out of the bottom of their phone, like just in public. I went into a public bathroom yesterday, and there was some kid like in the stall. You know, some people read when they go to the bathroom. This kid was listening to music or YouTube.
Yeah.
Right. On speakerphone, right? I'm like, dude.
And it sounds terrible.
Well, it sounds terrible. And
I've seen people running before, jogging with their music playing aloud out of the phone speaker.
Yeah.
I've been in situations where you're a room full of people and you want tunes and someone just turns their phone on and it sounds terrible. Yeah.
Well, and it sounds terrible. And then you're inflicting your music upon me. Like in, you know, in this bathroom I was in, this person you know, was listening to rap music, which is fine, right? But it was literally using the N-word as every fourth word, right? Which, okay, that's fine, but I don't really care, but, you know, we're in the YMCA, right?
Those songs are fine in private.
Yeah, somebody 65 years old could have come in here, right? And that's not okay with them, yeah. Likely, right? I don't know. And it occurred to me... I don't know why I'm telling this bathroom story. It occurred to me when I was hearing this, I'm like, I wonder if when you're writing this song, if you get a certain illicit joy, if you get a certain thrill of thinking to yourself, man, there's going to be a bunch of white kids screaming out these lyrics. And that's going to be hilarious to me because they're not allowed. You know. I don't know. I feel like if I was a musician, if I was writing lyrics for songs, my job would be to see, you know, what can I get people to say? Right? Because people, you know, say the lyrics to songs a lot of times without even really thinking about what it is that you're saying, right?
Right.
There's a melody and you're just kind of doing the lyrics.
Yeah.
And eventually you might realize, you know, wow, I'm talking about something truly bad, right? Or I'm talking about something that I really don't believe in, but man, that tune is really catchy.
Yeah. So, tangent, have you listened to the Beyonce's new record?
Oh, Lemonade?
Yeah.
No.
You're familiar with this?
Yes.
She does a very good job of doing interesting lyrical things and lots of subtext. Mm-hmm. Lots of analysis that you could do on what she's really saying in her lyrics, which just kind of made me think about that. Lots of times people are like, really? Is that what Beyonce was saying? Jeez. When she performed at the Super Bowl, there was a lot of complaining about, you know, there was Black Power subtext, or not even subtext, but like blatant, you know, with the costumes and stuff, this like Black Power feeling or in the lyrics. I think she does a really interesting job of thought-provoking lyrics.
Yeah.
And her music's great.
I read all that commentary, you know, about Black Power, and I came away from it saying, yeah, but so what?
Yeah, I think because she's a woman, that's something that women traditionally have not, you know, gone down that path lyrically, and I think that's why. I don't care.
Yeah, I'm all for it, man.
She's a great musician. But the other reason for bringing that up, okay, so when she put that out, there was like this HBO exclusive where they had I guess it was kind of like a documentary of her performing, you know, along with the release of this album. It, you know, got really great reviews. I wanted to see it. I turned on my HBO Now one night and it was there, like on a Friday night. I'm like, oh yeah, I'm definitely going to have to see that. The next week I go back to watch it, gone.
Really?
It was a limited time release. It was on HBO for like a long weekend.
And then gone.
It's gone. Now you got to buy it.
Oh.
I haven't seen that. I mean, you can't buy it through HBO. Like I could go on iTunes and buy it. That's kind of shady. I'm not all about that.
Why is it shady?
Well,
woman's got to get paid.
I don't know. I don't like expiring. I understand stuff will be on HBO for a month or 3 months and it'll say this is going to expire on this date, you know, and you can sort by when things are expiring and I can make sure I get something watched by the time it's gone. But that didn't say it was like Beyonce exclusive Lemonade and then it was just gone. It didn't say, I guess I want a red pop-up that says you better watch this now because you have like 72 hours.
So what Shady is saying, my new album will never be on any streaming service other than Tidal. And then 6 weeks later, shipping it on Apple Music.
Well, she kind of did that too. It was on Tidal for like a 24-hour exclusive.
Yeah, but she didn't tell her whole fans that it's never going to be anywhere else.
True.
Unlike
who has done that?
It was who owns Tidal? Is that?
Oh, that's
Jay-Z.
Yeah.
Yeah. So his album, he's like, this is never going to be anywhere other than Tidal, right? And so a bunch of people signed up for Tidal to get it, and then 6 weeks later, it's on iTunes.
Yeah.
Right. And I assume what that means is the sales of the album were low, right? Like the money you're making from Tidal and the sales of it on Tidal was not enough to compensate for the loss of all the fans that were like, ah, well, fine. You know, my money's here. I'm listening to the music that's here, right? It's 99% of the music.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go do this other thing just for you. Which is kind of how I feel about video, right? Like, the only reason I ever would watch anything about on Amazon Prime Video is because I've had Amazon Prime for a long time because I'm impatient, and when I click the button on Amazon, I want the stuff right now. And they're like, hey, you get fast shipping. We're also going to give you, you know, this video thing. Great. If it was a separate charge, I'd be like, eh, screw you. Not doing it, right? Which is like Hulu. People are like, oh, do you have Hulu too? You do Netflix? No, Hulu is dumb. I'm not going to pay money and watch commercials. Mm. Those guys are idiots, yeah. Right? Yahoo Red? Eh, nope. Netflix already gets my money, right? I want everything to be on Netflix. That's what I want.
So this is just my most recent, you know, gripe with the current state of content distribution shenanigans.
Yeah, well,
it's here, it's not here, then it's here, it'll be here later, it might not be here. You better watch it this weekend. I hope you don't have anything else going on, or you're going to miss it. Duh.
I wonder when somebody's going to make a VHS machine for streaming.
What do you mean?
Well,
for like recording streaming?
Yeah. Like,
well, yeah, I mean, there's digital rights management stuff embedded.
Yeah, but that's just a, you know, that's a relatively insecure algorithm written by people,
yeah,
who probably don't.
I mean, I think there are a lot of ways to crack this stuff, and that's how people put like Netflix shows on BitTorrent kind of thing.
It's not even necessarily that you want to download it on a BitTorrent. Like, it would be, you know, in this Beyonce thing, you'd be like, okay, I'm willing to stream it. I'm willing to do the thing, to show them I streamed it. And so they, you know, I'm paying my monies. They're getting the stream. They're getting the count. You know, I get all the ads, whatever it is. But I want to get those bits down to me and then time shift it from the weekend that I'm busy to the Tuesday night, right, where I'm going to start it and be done with it by 10 o'clock so I can go to bed on time. Right. But
I mean, that's how pay-per-view works now with digital distribution. Like, if I have a Dish and I do a pay-per-view movie, it'll get downloaded and then I have like 72 hours or whatever to watch it. But the clock doesn't start ticking until I start watching it. It's like that on Amazon too. If I rent a movie on Amazon.
Yeah, iTunes is that way.
Yeah.
But with streaming, that's not the option.
No.
Right? But time shifting is a legal thing. Right? I want to stream this thing when it's available, and then I want to time shift it to a time that's convenient for me.
I think that ends up being some kind of a hybrid where, you know, you can either stream it or you can download it with restrictions kind of thing. But, I mean, it's semantics. What's the difference between streaming it and recording it and downloading the video file if I'm not watching it while it's being played?
Is there
a difference? It's just the order that the bits came.
Yeah, but it's the only legal means that you can theoretically watch this thing with your HBO Now subscription was to stream it. In the time where you could do it. Right. I think if you actually had a VHS, right, and you could convert that video back out to, you know, regular composite video, you could have plugged it into VHS and recorded it.
And this is why people steal content.
Yeah, well, it's certainly harder. Right, it's like all this stuff is digital.
Because
it's
you're proposing that I record it on a magnetic tape. That's why I would steal it.
Yeah, because it's dumb.
Because your solution that you're spitballing is so ridiculous.
Well, it's just an example as a thought experiment.
When I want to watch it, I will steal it.
Because F you. Yeah. What? Yeah. I don't understand that at all, but
it's a lot of experimentation. I think we maybe have another year or two to go of this. I feel like we're still in the experimentation phase of how can I maximize my profits with my distribution deal? What are my options? I think consolidation is going to start happening soon. We aren't going to have all these competing services forevermore.
Maybe not. It's my view that It's the Comcast and the Charter Communications of the world that really need to die.
Yeah.
Right? Because they suck up a tremendous amount of money, and they're vested in the previous model, not the next model. Right? The next model gets rid of all of their stupid crap. It delivers me the bits at a time that's convenient for me, and then lets me view them at a time and place of my choosing. Right? I don't want to do this for free. I want to pay for it. But nobody's standing around willing to take my money.
Mm-hmm.
Like even Netflix is sometimes dumb, right? It's like, you know, I want to watch, you know, the next season of, you know, Jessica Jones or whatever. But I'm going to be on an airplane, Netflix, for God's sakes. Let me download it and put it on my damn iPad and watch it when it's convenient to me, when I'm not connected to the internet.
Mm.
What's wrong with you? Why can't you do this? Amazon can. Right? So, I don't know.
Stay tuned.
Okay. I think next week we're taking off because you're going to be traveling. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay.
We could reschedule, and we're going to talk about, here, we'll get this in public. We're going to talk about The Millionaire Next Door.
Which I have finished reading.
And I have not, because I'm the loser, but now I have to finish it so we can talk about it the book next airing.
Book review.
All right.
You're going to give a book report on The Millionaire Next Door. That's what's going to happen.
Okay.
All right. Until then.
See ya.